Begin tonight, so we'll look at Revelation 15, the last part of it. We need to say a little more about that before we go on into 16. And what we're getting ready for here is the bowls of wrath, and we will see all seven of these bowls poured out in chapter 16. And when we deal with the trumpets, the blowing of the trumpets, which kind of correspond, takes chapter 8. 9, 10, and 11. So it's interesting that here all seven of the bowls are in one chapter. So here in chapter 15, you have the song of Moses, the servant of God, the song of the Lamb. And this song is a symbol of victory, just like the song of Moses was when it was sung at the crossing of the Red Sea in Exodus 14 and 15. So then there are the words of that song in chapter 15, verses 3 and 4. And then in verse 5, this is chapter 15, verse 5. After these things I saw, and the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven was opened. So here is a temple that is opened. There came out from the temple the seven angels that had the seven plagues arrayed with precious stones. So we have seven angels that have come out with these bowls. Now, the King James Version is what uses the expression vials, V-I-A-L-S, vials. But the word from the reading that I did is a shallow bowl type of a thing. We think of a vial as a little beaker or a little flask or something like that. But the idea of the bowl is that's a pretty good translation of it. A fairly shallow dish, and so on. And so the seven angels that had the seven plagues, arrayed with precious stone, pure and bright, girt about their breast with golden girdles, or golden sashes or belts. Now that sounds a lot like, at least resembles somewhat, the Son of Man that's described in chapter 1 of Revelation with a sash about his chest. Do you remember that feature back there in chapter 1? So, these seven angels are adorned that way. One of the four living creatures gave unto the seven angels seven golden bowls full of the wrath of God. Now, here are the bowls, these golden bowls. And so I was talking to you about them, whether you call them a vial or a bowl. And in verse 8, the temple was filled with smoke. Now, there are three passages that really come to mind in connection with this. The temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God, from His power, and none was able to enter into the temple till the seven plagues of the seven angels should be finished. So I wanted to look at those passages briefly. The first one is in Exodus 40. Do you know which one that is? Do you remember? Does that ring a bell in your mind? What's going on in Exodus 40? Do you remember? They're setting up the tabernacle. Remember, they receive their instructions for how to build the tabernacle in 25 through 30. And then you have the workers that were going to do it in 31, the ones that were going to lead the workers, Bezalel and Aholiab. They were going to do lead the work. And so then in the latter part of the book, pretty well 35 through 40, we have the building of it. 32, 33, and 34 is telling about the sin of the golden calf. And then 35, it resumes with the instructions about how the instructions for making the garments and making the tabernacle and making the furniture, all of that was carried out. So here in chapter 40, look at the close of the chapter, verse 34. So Moses finished the work, and verse 34 says, "Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle, and Moses was not able to enter into the tent of meeting, because the cloud abode thereon, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle." Now, does everybody see that? You know, it's just, what impression do you get when you read that description right there? All right, God is in there, and the fact that here the cloud, what does it say filled the tabernacle in verse 34? It says the cloud covered the tent of meeting, but what does it say filled the tabernacle? The glory of the Lord. So I think that what we're being impressed with here is the glory of the Lord twice. You know, at least in verse 35 it mentions it again. The glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. So we are impressed, I think, with the glory of the Lord and with His power and majesty. Making the point that He was there. You know, if they had built this tabernacle and then they said, well, we're finished. It's now God's. It's His. I hope He likes it. Nothing happened. Then everybody would go away with a feeling of, well, how about that? But when the glory of the Lord came, the cloud covers the tabernacle, the glory of the Lord fills that tabernacle, then all question is removed about whether God accepted this. You know, it was done after the pattern. He accepted it. His glory filled it. And so I think that was a very impressive thing. Harold? Yes. That's right. All right, let's go to another passage where the same kind of thing happens. Can you guess which one this one is in connection with the building of Solomon's temple? Okay, 1 Kings chapter 8. 1 Kings chapter 8. And so they likewise have built this house according to the pattern that was given to David by the Lord and which David gave to Solomon. It's 1 Kings 8 and verse 10, verses 10 and 11. And it came to pass, when the priests were come out of the holy place, that the cloud filled the house of the Lord, so that the priest could not stand to minister by reason of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. So again, we have the cloud mentioned, and we have the glory of the Lord mentioned, which filled the temple. So, that's two episodes now that we have in the Bible. We have in Israelite history. And so here now at the close of Revelation 15, where we're beholding this temple of God, the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from His power, and none was able to enter into the temple. Now, so far, that's the point in all three cases. None was able to enter into the temple or the tabernacle, as the case was at first. But here we add, till the seven plagues of the seven angels should be finished. So when I put all of this together with these other two passages that talk about that, the only thing that I can really put together from that is just that impression of the power and the majesty of God here in His temple. When it says none was able to enter into the temple, now for example, these angels had come out, and it's just saying there's not going to be any going or coming from the temple until this is finished. So the only thing I can say is that it enhances the fact that what is about to happen is an act of God. It is an act of God. It is something that God is causing to happen. Just like there couldn't have been any question about this is the glory of the Lord back there in the tabernacle. This is the glory of the Lord in Solomon's temple. Well, this is the glory of the Lord here. And what is being done always is to glorify the Lord, to glorify Him, and He is glorifying Himself. So it's interesting there in verse 8 of Revelation 15 how similar that is to those first two episodes. And obviously, the Spirit bases that passage, that description, upon those previous two stories that we read about. All right, so as we look now at these seven angels who have come out, they are specially arrayed, and they come out. And notice in verse 7, one of the four living creatures gave unto the seven angels seven bowls. So, in your mind, as you try to picture this happening, don't picture it as that the angels kind of came out in single file, and as they came out in single file, each one had his bowl. You see that? But rather, the seven angels all came out. And then one of the four living creatures gave unto the seven angels seven bowls, seven golden bowls full of the wrath of God, who liveth forever and ever. So we know that these bowls are full of the wrath of God. So rather than worrying too much about the bowls themselves, let us focus on the wrath of God, because the wrath of God is something that we can deal with in a practical manner. We can understand the idea of the wrath of God. As we have read through Revelation so far, what have you been impressed with regard to the saints? What's the problem? What are the problems that the saints are facing? They're facing persecution. They're also facing, and that's of course one of the main things being emphasized, but they also are facing every other force, every other power, every other thing that people on earth generally do face: the weather, famine, war, stuff like that. They face temptation. They face all of these things. Now then, where have we read that the evil in this world comes from? Who are the ones that are involved? Who are the principal players in the evil? They've already been introduced. Who was the one introduced in chapter 12? That was the dragon. Who is he? That's Satan. We have had the beast from the sea introduced in the first half of Revelation 13, and we have said that he corresponds with that fourth beast in Daniel 7, which was the Roman Empire. And so here was the Roman Empire exerting all of its power, handing over its power to the devil to use. And what would the devil try to use the power of the Roman Empire to do? What would he want to do with it? And stop. Crush. Absolutely crush it. Did he succeed? No. So here's the dragon, here's the beast, and then that second beast from the earth, and they're all working to crush the saints. They're all working to thwart God and to stop Him. Now, does this create any occasion for wrath from God? Do you see? I just want you to see how simple and how powerful that pattern is. That we behold the suffering of the saints. What did we hear them asking beneath the altar in Revelation 6? How long, O Lord, till You avenge our blood? There is occasion for wrath. And here are these players of evil. And so, here's the bowls of wrath. The bowls of wrath. Well, see now what will be done with the bowls of wrath. But we can kind of figure it out. The wrath of God is going to be poured out upon those who have been doing these things. And I remind you that in spite of all the efforts of the devil and of the Roman Empire, the power, the state, the false religion that was working hand in hand with the state, moving men to worship the emperor, to worship the state, have they succeeded? Did they succeed in preventing God from establishing His kingdom? No, they did not. Do you remember the psalm that foretold that? The second psalm. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. That's right. That's right. And in Daniel 2:44, that was predicted, wasn't it? Kingdom will be established that will break in pieces all these kingdoms. All right, look in 16 now. I heard a great voice out of the temple saying to the seven angels, Go ye and pour out the seven bowls of the wrath of God into the earth. Now this would be a fun thing to do here. Who is this? The answer, it doesn't say. So what we can do is we can guess. We can say it's probably God. Well, it probably is. It's probably Christ. It probably is. But if it's not one of them, we know from whom ultimately the command comes, don't we? So whether it's one of the living creatures, whether it's a special angel, wherever, whoever it is, we know ultimately from whom is the voice coming. It's from God, because He is the one that is totally in charge. Remember back over there in chapter 14 where we have the white cloud and the one like a son of man sitting on that cloud with a crown of gold and everything like that? Who gave him the order? Where did that order come from? Remember, another angel came out from the temple and gave the order. But it came from God. Yeah, Mike? Well, it might have been somebody already in the temple that... Yes, but they may have already been in it. So they didn't enter it, but they were there already. I'm just saying that possibility is why I hesitate to say, oh, it couldn't have been anybody else. So that's fine, you know. But I think that you've got to consider that possibility. But the thing is, ultimately, this command comes from God, whether it is from Him directly or whether it is through an intermediary of some kind that was already there. This is the idea. And I sure wouldn't argue with you about that, Mike. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, nobody in there. Yeah. So I wouldn't argue with you about it. But in my own mind, that would be why I would have a reservation about really affirming that. But I think that's good. That's good thinking. 16:1, the command, go ye and pour out the seven bowls of the wrath of God into the earth. Now, when you begin to read about the pouring out of this wrath, the very first thing is the first went and poured his bowl into the earth. Well, that first command said, go pour out the seven bowls of wrath into the earth. I think that means that's a general statement. That is not specifying the earth in the sense that verse 2 is. So verse 1, I think, is using the earth in a more general sense to include all of the places and all of the things that will be ultimately be involved. Otherwise, you're just repeating the thing. So I think that verse 2 then is specifying. It begins the breakdown. So the first went and poured his bowl into the earth. I don't know if you have gone to the trouble to do it or not, but if you were to go back to the trumpets and read about the blowing of the trumpets and what those trumpets affected, you would find that it is the same, the correspondence is the same all through here. So if you went back and looked in 8:7, you would find that the first trumpet had to do with the earth. The first went and poured his bowl into the earth, and it became a noisome and grievous sore upon the men that had the mark of the beast and that worshipped his image. I think we won't do it necessarily, but let's look back. Kind of fix it where you can turn back and forth. I think it would help. In verse 7 of chapter 8, when the first trumpet sounded, there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth, and the third part of the earth was burnt up, and the third part of the trees was burnt up, and all green grass was burnt up. The point is, that was not total. That was not total. There here in chapter 16 and verse 2, the first went and poured out his bowl into the earth, and it became a noisome and grievous sore upon the men that had the mark of the beast and that worshipped his image. That's right. It was a warning in 8:7. Here it is a pouring out of the wrath of God. Now, as we think about what this means and what the actual, you know, what the actual fulfillment of this would be, there is the possibility that it would be talking about earthly calamities. Only problem with talking about earthly calamities is that the ill effects of this bowl is limited to whom? Even more. became a noisome and grievous sore upon the men that had the mark of the beast and worshipped his image. Therefore, instead of believing that this is referring necessarily to physical calamities here in this first bowl of wrath that affect the earth as opposed to the sea, it may be that it is talking about being poured out upon the kingdom. Maybe the kingdom, maybe this empire that is in power. The effects of the evil that went on in that empire had repercussions upon the empire itself. And I believe that throughout these bowls, throughout the pouring out of these bowls, there is an emphasis upon the results of the evil that these people do because they are allied with the dragon and with the beast, because they are his servants. So as we go through here, I think we will see that going on. It makes sense to me. I can't go beyond that. I think that's what it's talking about there in verse 2 when it says upon the earth. The contrast is the sea. And we've already studied back in chapter 13. Now, Buford and Jerry, Mike, some of them were teaching during that chapter primarily. And the idea of the sea, you go back into the Old Testament and the idea of the sea. Daniel 7, the beasts, the four beasts came up out of the sea. The sea is used in prophecy of the sense of society as a whole. Society as a whole. Regardless of whether it's this empire or that kingdom over there, this is society as a whole. So if that be the case, then the earth, the bowl poured out upon the earth, might be referring to the Roman Empire, which at this time was the kingdom turning its power, the empire turning its power over to the devil. And the second one, the second bowl, would be talking about society as a whole, that the effects of evil and the effects of a society's participation in that evil, the repercussions of that were going to come upon them. And it's really interesting and it's kind of scary. You look around you in the world today. You think about the Middle East, where Christianity is considered absolutely illegal, abominable, and has been for centuries. And so we say, so what's going on over there? They're killing and killing and killing. Why are they doing that? Devotion to their God. Devotion to their religion. Islam is driving them to do that. What are the results? The results are the results of the things they themselves are doing. The results are because of their commitment to a false way. And it's not only there, though. Then you look at Europe. And you try to go to France and try to convert somebody. Try to go to Scandinavia. Most of the Scandinavian countries that I've heard about are that way. Where's a good and honest heart? The world, by its evil, brings consequences upon itself. Now, who has ordained that those consequences will come when the world devotes itself to evil? I believe it is God. And I believe these are the bowls of His wrath. And the bowls of His wrath come out. And ultimately they culminate. They actually do culminate in even physical manifestations, such as eventually the fall of Rome. The rise and the fall of empires. The rise and fall of governments. Assyria rose up. God used it as His rod. When He was finished using Assyria, bending it to His purposes, then He had them destroyed. And so God uses the consequences of evil to bring about the doom of the nations and society.
Kept from buying and selling and thus had to do without.
I certainly do. That's right. And even though one of the points that he's already made earlier is that though the Christian often suffers at the hands of evil, the Christian does not suffer the effects of evil itself. We are shielded from that as long as we maintain our allegiance unto God. And so I do think, Fred, I do think it would be encouraging to the people to realize that whatever this, the wrath of God, listen, you know, I mean, I really feel this way. Suppose North Korea succeeded in sending a missile over here with a huge nuclear device, and it just pretty well wiped most of us out. That would be the result of a very evil act. Would I have participated in that evil? No. I would be dead. But where would I be? Where would you be? Now, if we participate in the evil itself, then we will have the noisome and grievous sores upon us. In other words, the spiritual effects. But if we maintain our allegiance to God and our devotion to Him, we are shielded from that. And so, Fred, I think that's the comfort that would come. And the older I get, the more I am finding that you call it worry. It's not really worry. It is a thing we ought to make our priority. Now, what matters to me more and more is to be ready to go to heaven. That's what matters. That's what matters. You read the paper, listen to the news, and what matters is be ready to go to heaven. Live to go to heaven. Harold? Yes. That's right. Exactly. They were given, hear God, even in this, now in the trumpets, definitely with a warning, but even in this, you're right, Harold, even in this, the point is being made occasionally, like in verse 11. In fact, the last part of verse 9, men were scorched with great heat, and they blasphemed the name of God who hath power over these plagues, and they repented not to give Him glory. In the last of verse 11, they repented not of their works. So yes, that's right. But if they did, then they too could be shielded from the effects of moral and spiritual evil. Yes, Buford? Yes. That's right. Exactly. That's right. With the final judgment, there won't be any opportunity to repent. There won't be any point, and they repented not. There won't be any repenting available. So that's a very good point. Yes. In some societies, it's the pressure to conform and fear.
Fear is something that a lot of us never had.
Yes.
And life, you began then to value it.
Right. That's right. All right, look at the third bowl now. The third poured out his bowl into the rivers and the fountains of the waters, and it became blood. And I heard the angel of the waters. Now, by the way, as we read these, you can also say, that kind of reminds me of one of the plagues in Egypt. So once in a while, one of them particularly reminds you of that. You know, I mean, I can think of even the first one there about the took the dust of the furnace and threw it up, and it became boils. one of the plagues in Egypt. That's remind verse 2 there. That bowl reminded me of that. Verse 2, here's blood. And now in verse 4, the third bowl has to do with the rivers and fountains of waters becoming blood like the first plague in Egypt. And I heard the angel of the waters saying, "Righteous art thou who art and who wast, thou Holy One, because thou didst thus judge." So here is the verdict that this is done and it is right. The one who is carrying this out, the one who is having these things carried out, he is doing what is right. Righteous art thou. What about that? How long, O Lord, till you avenge our blood? Okay. Here he's doing some of that. This is not the final judgment. Because notice what else he says. Verse 6. "For they poured out the blood of saints and prophets, and blood hast thou given them to drink." Their own. Their own blood. "They are worthy," meaning they deserve it. "They have brought this upon themselves. And I heard the altar saying, 'Yea, O Lord God the Almighty, true and righteous are thy judgments.'" Now, it's a whole lot more important for us to pay attention to what the altar said than to decide which altar it was. So when we talk about the altar, let's just don't talk about that very much. And let's focus instead on what the altar said. There are two possibilities for the altar. One is the altar beneath which the souls of them that had been beheaded said, "How long, O Lord, till you judge and avenge us," and so on. The other is the idea of the altar of incense, which has been mentioned a number of times in connection with fire from the altar being cast down upon the earth and prayers of the saints ascending and things like that. So I'm not sure which one it is, but it could be either one of those. And so the altar is saying, as if it were personified or maybe someone in charge of the altar, there's an angel of the altar mentioned earlier. So that may be what it's talking about. But anyway, the voice that is saying, stating, "Yea, O Lord God, the Almighty, true and righteous are thy judgments." Again, I just have to kind of guess. I have to kind of guess. And I'm not real sure about my guesses. But when I look at verses 4 through 7, and I remember that so far we've been looking at the results of spiritual evil coming upon those who practice it, then I lean to the idea that these rivers and so on and the fountains are talking about the pollution of the sources of ideas here upon the earth. Our newspapers, our television, our communications, our internet things that are misused, and the false teaching that goes on from pulpits, the false teaching that goes on in the world from whatever source it may be, it's defiled, it's polluted, it cannot be depended upon. And I think that probably is the idea. And so they can't be drunk. They're blood. They've turned to blood. You can't drink them. So that's the idea. Now then, here's a question. He's already been making a distinction in the saints and the wicked. So is this saying, so the saints can't drink of it? Well, no, the saints couldn't drink of it before, because it had turned evil. Now who can't drink of it? The wicked. So I rather think that he's talking about the corruption and the defilement even of the things that the wicked would say. Oh, this is what we will do. Kind of reminds me of prophecies like Obadiah when he talked about Edom. And Edom was famed for its wisdom. So if Edom was in trouble, what would Edom be thinking? Oh, that's okay. We can take care of it because we have what? Wisdom. God says, "I will turn your wisdom to foolishness so that it will not be any help to you." Now here, I think about things like, you know, when you read the paper today, you hear interviews, you see people stating what they think or what they believe. You hear psychologists, psychiatrists telling us about human behavior, have them talking to us about rearing children, for example. You go to the legal system. And frankly, the legal system is the last place I'd like to go to settle a matter of justice and injustice. So what is all that saying? That the rivers and the fountains are already defiled. They're already corrupted. But God has His way of turning those into something that people know, that even the wicked know. I can't drink this. This is not going to help me. And so I rather think that that's probably what verses 4 through 7 are talking about in connection with this bowl that's poured out upon the rivers and the fountains and things like that. Now the fourth one, the fourth poured out His bowl upon the sun. Now again, if you did keep going back over to chapter 8, you'll find that the correspondence continues to be there. And in chapter 8 and verse 12, and the fourth angel sounded, and the third part, hear that? Again, that's one of the differences. The third part sounded, and the third part, the sun was smitten, the third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars, that the third part of them should be darkened, and that the day should not shine for the third part of it, and the night in like manner. But over here, when He pours His bowl upon the sun, it was given unto it to scorch men with fire. You know, you could say, now, why, you know, you would think He would say, it completely put it out. Because what did it say happened in 8:12? A third of it. A third of the moon and a third of the stars. But here, instead of talking about, you would think He'd go ahead and say, It just blotted out the whole thing. No. He changes the direction just a little bit because He is showing that whatever this is, it is positively causing damage. Instead of the sun giving light, what's it doing? It's just burning it up. It's just toasting it. Again, rather than this talking about the literal sun, I think it's talking about leaders, people like that. And you listen to them, and after a while, what they do is not only false, harmful, but it becomes malignant. It becomes malignant, and the society begins to feel the effects. It begins to burn and it begins to shrivel. And what does the society do? Do they get it? Men were scorched with great heat. You hear these people who are atheists, and they, like Carl Sagan, who is now dead, and all the evidence in the world does not change them. And so after a while, these men were scorched with great heat. And I'm not saying that's talking about hell. I'm not saying that's talking about hell. I don't think it's talking about hell. I think it's talking about things that are going on now with the leaders of the world, the teachers, the influencers. And they're not only teaching stuff that's wrong, they're not only misleading, they're doing tremendous harm. And the men were scorched with great heat, and they blasphemed the name of God, even in the face of their suffering the consequences. They blaspheme the name of God who hath the power over these plagues, and they repented not to give Him glory. So, as the world suffers from its own evil, you know, you and I tend to think that, we'll sometimes think, oh, things are going to get bad enough. People are going to wake up one of these days. What does this indicate? It's going to get worse. No, they're not going to wake up because they don't get it. They don't want to get it. They're not going to get it. So, evil men will wax worse and worse. Now, the fifth. Now, notice 1, 2, 3, 4. We have the earth, the sea, the rivers and fountains of blood, and the sun. Now, number 5, the symbol drastically changes. From symbols having to do with the earth, verse 10, the fifth poured out His bowl upon the throne of the beast, and His kingdom was darkened, and they gnawed their tongues for pain. If you watch any of the documentaries about the Roman Empire, I don't know which emperor I would have rather lived under. They all acted like they were insane. And their power would almost make them insane. And as this went on and on and on, the kingdom of, or the empire of Rome, crumbled and disintegrated from inside as the moral and spiritual fiber of the people deteriorated. They gnawed their tongues for pain, and they blasphemed the God of heaven because of their pains and their sores, and they repented not of their works. So, you know, you take our country, and we have the catastrophe happen like 9/11. We've got our senators out on the steps singing Praise the Lord or something, some religious song. And, God Bless America. And, boy, we're all, how long did that last? How long was it before we started saying, oh, we've got to be careful here because we can't give Jesus, we can't give God glory through Jesus because that would offend the Jews, that would offend the Muslims, that would offend the so-and-so. And it all just, it was foam, it was a facade, it was so temporary, it was sad. They repented not of their works. Well, our time is almost gone. Has the first bell rung? Not even the first. Okay. Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell you about Harmageddon. In Hebrew, Har, H-A-R, Har, is a mountain. And Mageddon is the idea of Megiddo. Well, the thing is, although Megiddo is built upon a mound, or a tell, there's not actually a mountain there. So this is not talking about a literal place here. This is talking about a confrontation. And the interesting thing to me is that if you read what it says there, there isn't any battle. There isn't one. You go over into 19, where they all gather together, and oh man, here they are coming. They're all gathered together, and just suddenly, and they're all gathered together. The battle's about to happen. And the next thing, and the beast was taken. Wasn't much of a battle. The beast was taken. I always look at it like he was some kind of a possum or something. And the Lord just reached down and grabbed me by the scruff. A pest. Let us never get the idea that the Lord has trouble overcoming the devil. The devil's nearly as strong as he is. Don't ever get that idea. And I think sometimes men leave that idea in their comments. John Milton, so many years ago, said, we would scarce know how strong God is if we did not know how strong the devil is. Well, the devil doesn't even compare. He's powerful, yes. Powerful. But compared to God?